Our second case for argument this morning is Isaacs against Hill's Pet Nutrition. Mr. Durst.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. The District Court in this case recognized that a violation of sexual harassment is one continuous violation. However, the Court in this case ignored and refused to consider the acts before October 15, 2001, when the plaintiff was moved from one work area to another by the supervisor, Everett Jenkins. The supervisor, Everett Jenkins, was a supervisor of both areas. Of course, he was supervisor of packaging and he was supervisor of stretch wrap. The district court stated that it was ignoring those facts because of different job duties, different coworkers, and I forget the third one, but neither of those three were any reason for ignoring the facts. The court, district court, did not cite any evidence, or excuse me, did not cite any authority except Morgan, and Morgan's facts are completely contrary to that. For instance, Morgan involved a railroad yard in which the racial harassment was over a period of several years and involved five different supervisors. In this case, it involved the same supervisor. The fact that there were somewhat different job duties has never been recognized as a reason to ignore the evidence or to say that it is not part of the sexual harassment. In fact, in this particular plant, the employees were required to work in any area, and it's even less of a difference in this case. Even if the court had ignored the facts for liability, the court was also in error in ignoring the facts on admissibility because the facts are, even if they're not part of a liability violation, such as discrete acts before the time period of the violation are admissible, and Morgan cites that even for discrete acts. Secondly, the district court for post-charge, EEOC charge acts, recognized that they were related for the sexual harassment charge and considered them for the sexual harassment charge, but somehow said that they were not related to the retaliation and discrimination charge. That is contrary to the Seventh Circuit law, which states in Malhotra, for instance, that reasonably related later acts and also any retaliatory acts arising out of the first charges are to be considered and part of the action. Furthermore, it would create a terrible situation. Under the court's order, the proposed proceedings would be that there would be one trial, including and considering the post-charge acts for sexual harassment, and then there would be a second trial, encouraging employees to file third and subsequent charges and repeated charges over and over again before the EEOC. And then there would be a second, third, and fourth trial involving acts which had already been considered in the first trial in sexual harassment. So that would really be untenable and multiply the work of the EEOC and the courts. It would not make any sense when the courts have considered the acts for sexual harassment and then in a second trial would be asked to consider the acts for discrimination and retaliation. The Malhotra case even sets out a bright line and states that for any retaliation, that is to be included in the first action. If multiple cases are filed, then courts get upset, of course, because of the increased work and because we've already heard this, and the courts do not want that. The third point was that the adverse actions taken against the plaintiff were ignored to a great extent by the district court, in that the district court ignored totally the terminations which had resulted from the transfer, the IIP, the medical leave. Because she took medical leave, she was terminated. Is terminated in August. That's disputed, but of course, on a motion for summary judgment, what we have to consider is that she was terminated. And then she was definitely terminated again for the same thing when she was sexually harassed and had to take medical leave in 2004 and then was terminated in 2005.
All these leaves that she took, these stress leaves, were they all related to the harassment?
Yes, all of them. And also to the retaliation of the supervisor, Everett Jenkins, the same supervisor who refused to correct or do anything to Tom Kitchell, who was sexually harassing her with the grossest hurtful statements, sexual statements, and against Chris White, who was sabotaging her machine. Instead of correcting them, he sent her to another area to learn, a new area. She had no mentor. She was there near Memorial Day night, and her male coworker was not working, was not doing his checks. She complained again to Everett Jenkins, to whom she had complained before. Everett Jenkins did nothing to the male coworker, and yet blamed her for not doing checks when she was trying to do the checks for two people. Court also said that the sexual harassment was not severe or pervasive. And, of course, it's very difficult to ignore the evidence before and the evidence after and then say before the charge and the evidence after the charge and then say that, well, there's no evidence that it was pervasive in other areas or that it was severe. And so this was very severe, as the facts in the brief show. It resulted in physically threatening work situations. She was her machine was sabotaged in packaging. Her hand was injured when Kitchell got mad at her and would not train her because she complained about him. She was sent a stretch wrap. Bill Pebworth told her that he'd sabotaged a machine of a female. And then, of course, he pushed 700 pounds of bags of product over and landed at her feet and then said, "See what can happen to you, bitch," which is very physically threatening. And in dry mix, her ears were grabbed and her head pulled down by a male and said, "Now write that in your little book." And they had said that the males had said that they knew about her her complaints against the company and even her lawsuit. So it was physically threatening. It was also psychologically injurious. Harris says that it does not have to be psychologically injurious, but in this case, it was to the extent that the company doctors, the EAP doctors, the EAP providers, placed her on medical leaves, had to do it successive medical leaves because the company kept failing to make any corrective action against the males. The court also said that there was no adverse action for retaliation. This was before the Burlington versus White Supreme Court decision, which held that transfer to different job duties was an adverse action for retaliation. So we have the transfer, the IIP, the medical leave, all of those resulting in terminations. Bless her heart, this lady did stick in there and try to put up with this terrible situation, but the employers did not do anything. The district court also said that Colgate was not an employer because the district court would not incorporate or recognize the incorporation by reference of the earlier facts in the brief of the plaintiff. The brief of the plaintiff showed that there were only three sentences relied upon by the employers to say that Colgate was not an employer. Those three sentences did not preclude Colgate from being an employer, and they were conclusory and objected to. But in spite of that fact, plaintiff submitted three pages in response to the three sentences. Plaintiff submitted three pages of facts, and the court simply ignored them. Under any legal standard, those facts, of three pages of facts, show that Colgate was one of the employers of the plaintiff. Now, there does not have to be just one employer, as the Seventh Circuit's cases show, that Colgate was involved directly and even admitted to the employees that it was the employer, held itself out as the employer, issued the policies, failed to take corrective action, said complaint to Colgate, and then failed to take corrective action. The district court was also in error in striking four entire affidavits. The employer's defendants objected to, for instance, four paragraphs of a 421-page affidavit of Elizabeth Bright Bender, and then just threw in at the last, strike all of her affidavit, but gave no legal basis for it. And the court, without any legal basis, struck all 421 paragraphs, even though there was a basis shown for only four paragraphs, and even that basis was just a dispute about what was happening on particular days. Another example is the defendants objected to three paragraphs of a 53-page affidavit of Dewey Lakes, the court, instead of just looking at the three paragraphs, struck the entire affidavit and other affidavits. Thank you. I will save my rebuttal time, and the EEOC has requested time to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Darst. Mr. Schur.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is John Suri, representing the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission on behalf of the appellant, Carol Isaacs. The commission's main purpose for being here today is to address the Morgan issue in this case. In considering the timeliness of a hostile environment claim, the Supreme Court stated in Morgan that provided that an act contributing to the claim occurs within the statutory filing period, the entire time period of the hostile environment may be considered by a court for the purposes of determining liability. Further, the court stated that both pre- and post-filing incidents are part of the same hostile environment unless the acts that occurred within the filing period have, quote, no relation to the acts, unquote, outside of the filing period, or, quote, for some other reason, such as certain intervening action by the employer, end quote, the prior acts are no longer a part of the same hostile environment. Despite the evidence in this case that Isaacs was subjected to a continuous pattern of harassment that began in packaging and continued into her employment when she was transferred to stretch wrap, the district court concluded under Morgan the behavior she endured while she was in packaging could not be considered part of the same environment. None of the reasons the court gave for this conclusion have merit. The court first stated that after her transfer, Isaacs worked in an entirely different area of the plant. However, evidence in the record shows that both packaging and stretch wrap are in relatively close proximity, and that the employees in those two areas are in close contact daily in order to coordinate the transfer of dependent product. Moreover, Kitchell, who was the main harasser of Isaacs when she was in packaging, came over to the stretch wrap area to engage in a conversation about Isaacs with Pebworth. Nevertheless, even after the transfer, the sexual remarks and obscene noises imitating sexual arousal, which occurred in packaging, also occurred in stretch wrap because they're done over the radio, which the employees in both sections of the plant use to communicate with one another. The court also said that Isaac's transfer to stretch wrap did not constitute an intervening action. However, a transfer to a new position with a new supervisor and new coworkers may constitute an intervening action where the harassment ceases, at least temporarily. Here, by contrast, the harassment of Isaac's did not stop when she was transferred from packaging to stretch wrap. There was one hostile environment here. It began in packaging and it continued in stretch wrap, and Hills took no intervening action that stopped it. Now, the appellee argues that transfers away from alleged harassers is a defining boundary between separate environments. But the cases Hills cite, like the cases we cite, are ones that involve a transfer with a new supervisor and new coworkers where at least temporarily the harassment ceased. The biggest change that resulted from the transfer was that Pebworth became Isaac's principal tormentor after the transfer, replacing Kitchell as her former tormentor. However, a plaintiff need not show that earlier acts of harassment were committed by the same individuals as were later acts in order to establish they're part of the same environment. Contrary to the district court's view, Isaacs offered evidence of a link between the acts and actors complained of in the two departments. There's evidence in the record that at the time she was transferred from packaging to stretch wrap, Kitchell came over to where Pebworth worked. They had a conversation, at which time during the conversation they were pointing at her, giggling, leering, and after the conversation, Isaacs asked Pebworth, "What were you talking about?" And Pebworth admitted they were talking about her. According to Isaacs, Pebworth just picked up where Kitchell left off. A reasonable jury could conclude that Kitchell encouraged Pebworth to harass Isaacs and that Pebworth was emboldened by the fact that defendant did nothing to stop Kitchell's harassment of her. The district court also erred in concluding that there wasn't enough evidence to support a finding that the conduct was sufficiently severe or pervasive to constitute a hostile work environment. The court decided that the activity was just rude and tactless and was not pervasive enough. But if you take into account all of the harassment that began in packaging, continued through to stretch wrap, even if you consider it to be low-level harassment, it is of such pervasive nature that it has become what, in Wilson versus Chrysler, this course referred to as an institutional norm. There are no other questions? I appreciate the court's time.
One question.
Yes, sir.
Does the EEOC have a position on the suit against Colgate-Palmolive, the stockholder in Hill's Pet Nutrition?
We do not, Your Honor.
Does the EEOC have a position on when, if ever, it is appropriate to treat a corporate parent as an employer under Title VII?
I'm sure we do, Your Honor, but I cannot tell you off the top of my head what it is.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Ms. Boshkoff.
Thank you. May it please the court.
If you want to lower the lectern, Ms. Boshkoff, there's a switch in the lower right.
No, not
the microphone. There's a switch on the lower right. On your right.
Right, give her a shot.
Exactly.
We have here, never mind, a lady's phone.
Excellent.
You can stop at any time.
Yeah,
you want.
That's
you
right.
Can choose.
I'm going to have to shrink now.
Position between high and low.
Whacker.
All right. Excellent. Thank you very much. The district court in this case waded through an incredible factual record, much of which was completely irrelevant. The court did a painstaking analysis of multiple legal theories and properly granted summary judgment. I'm going to summarize, and then I'm going to move on to the sexual harassment claims, which I think are of most interest to the court. As to disparate treatment and retaliation, several events are beyond the scope of the charge or the complaint and are time barred, and on the merits, the court properly found no adverse event for either retaliation or disparate treatment, and no evidence of disparate treatment. Now, moving on to sexual harassment, which I think is the major issue, at least what's brought the EEOC here today. We have two basic issues with respect to the sexual harassment. One, scope of the case. What's in the case? What's out of the case? The continuing violation doctrine, that's the old language. I think the new language is unitary sexual harassment. That's the first issue. The second issue is when you take the conduct that's properly in the case.
I don't understand your terminology. That what the Supreme Court describes this wrong as is a hostile environment. Sexual harassment is not a violation of any federal statute.
A hostile work environment as a species of sexual harassment.
No, it's a species of sex discrimination.
That's correct.
There is no federal law against harassing people.
You're absolutely
Maybe
right.
There should be, but there isn't.
You are absolutely right, and that does.
If there were, the courts might be guilty, but go ahead.
I think that's a very significant point, jumping ahead a little bit, because a lot of the conduct alleged here is simply offensive, rude, vulgar, completely inappropriate, absolutely, but not targeted to a particular gender. Or even a particular person because of gender. And we know from the Supreme Court's decision in the on-call case and other cases and cases this court has discussed that sexually offensive conduct isn't in and of itself sexual harassment. So I think that's a very, very critical point when we get to the idea of what's really sexual harassment and what's being alleged in this case. But before I move on to that, where I've rightly been corrected on my language, the first issue is really the timeliness issue. And what the district court did was apply the Morgan case, which is, of course, the controlling case on point. And the district court applied the Morgan case correctly and said only the conduct in the stretch wrap department is actionable. Now, the EEOC has come here.
And in terms of that Morgan case, wouldn't the narrowest grounds for affirming be that the EEOC couldn't investigate the firings because they happened after the investigation period had closed? In other words, it just wasn't timely.
That's as to the disparate treatment,
right.
Yes, exactly. As to the disparate treatment claim, and the Supreme Court in Morgan's pretty clear on this, every event of disparate treatment has to be part of a charge, and that is based on the very strong federal priority of having EEOC investigate. So as to the disparate treatment claim, anything that happened after the charges were closed, and the last charge, I believe, was closed in 2003, couldn't be part of an EEOC investigation. So those claims are out of the case. And that does relate to the disparate treatment. But to move back to the hostile work environment, we have a slightly different test under Morgan, which is it part of the same actionable harassment? The EEOC is talking to us, to this court, I should say, about misinterpreting the test or misapplying the test. But let there be no mistake about it. The district court did apply the correct legal standard. It cited the Morgan decision. It quoted the Morgan decision. It relied on the Morgan decision. What the EEOC and the plaintiff are complaining about here, or I should say the appellant, is that they don't think the court applied Morgan the right way to these facts. And I will submit to you that argument was waived. It was not made in the court below, and it should not be considered here.
So let's get back.
I don't understand that at all. The argument was actually addressed by the district court. An argument that's actually resolved by the district court and given as the ground of its decision not be available on appeal?
The argument that was addressed by the district court was our argument that the conduct was not timely. In response to that argument, the plaintiff in the court below merely invoked the Morgan decision, made no argument that you're hearing here. None of the points that the EEOC has made, none of the points the plaintiff has made about the supervisor, about this alleged conversation, about the open plan environment, none of those were presented to the district court. You can't just invoke a legal standard to the district court and then come and complain when the court hasn't applied it the way you want to the facts that you now want to argue. So invoking a legal standard, in our view, is not the same thing as arguing it.
Well, on this harassment, the various statements that Kitchell made that were very offensive, that were all based on, you know, he talked about sex on a daily basis, what his wife gave him or didn't give him, and just a whole number of things. You're saying those weren't focused at Isaac?
They weren't. There's not a single one of his comments that was focused at her. In fact, the comments were made to both men and women, and that one of the most cited comments is a comment that he made to a male coworker. Mr. Kitchell, I mean, I'm not going to excuse his behavior or say it was in any way acceptable because it was not, but it's not gender-based sexual harassment. Rude, crude, inappropriate conduct. He didn't make derogatory remarks about women. He didn't suggest a hostility to women in the workplace the way the Supreme Court says you could in on call. He didn't direct his comments only to women. He talked about sex and about his own sexual prowess.
And are there any statements where he talked about men or this was, you know, directed toward men other than himself personally? You said this was heard by men and women, but all of these comments have to do with women.
And
various sexual acts he wanted to perform or
He talked about he invited a man to engage in a sexual act with him. He said, come over, Dewey, and that conversation ensued. He talked about his own sexual experiences and things that he had done. And then he talked about things like, you know, experiences he had had with his wife. Those are the kinds of comments that Mr. Kitchell supposedly made. I don't know if that answered your question, but there was a comment directed to a man that said, come over, Dewey, and engage in this sexual experience with me.
And then when she got transferred, he made it a point to go over on her first day. And it, according to her testimony, he leered at her, giggled, pointed her to her while she was talking to Pebworth. And when she asked what was going on, Pebworth sneered. And after that, Pebworth also began to pick on her.
That is according to her testimony. But I think it's important as to that conversation, which the EEOC and the plaintiff or appellant are arguing establish a unitary harassment.
And with Pebworth, he was specifically directing his comments to her, wasn't he not?
Yes.
Like, you know, calling her a bitch, a fucking bitch, all these various things, referring to her weight and all that. That was directed directly toward her.
The few comments that we have in the record, and I think it's very important to look at the actual record as opposed to the characterizations of the record. There are three instances where he supposedly called her a bitch, three instances that she testified to. There are two instances where he supposedly made a reference to her weight. Those were directed to her. They were quite limited and quite different from what Mr. Kitchell allegedly did. When you think about the continuity of the alleged harassment, what we have in packaging is allegedly offensive, non-specific, non-hostile remarks. What we have in stretch wrap is a handful of comments directed towards her that aren't really gender-related. I mean, twice making comments about her weight, three times using the word bitch, three times is what she testified, and a handful of comments about things like, you better watch your back.
And then him driving his forklift into hers, knocking 700 pounds of pet food onto the floor?
What the evidence is in the record regarding the pallet incident, and again, I think we need to look at this from the standpoint of what's actually gender-based and what is their evidence is gender-based. The evidence that she testified to, she was standing, what she said in her testimony, not more than 20 feet away. He took his forklift. He pushed it up against hers. It knocked a pallet over. It was investigated by the company and found to be an accident. You've got to have more than that to say that's sexual harassment. That is another allegation relating to Mr. Pebworth.
And then this whole business of at night when she's in the parking lot and her car had been keyed and the license plate had been ripped off and then the lights were turned off at night and Kitchell was there.
There's no evidence. Those are separate events. But the first one, as to the license plate and the keys, it's supposedly in the plant parking lot. No evidence regarding who did that, male or female, or even whether it was somebody at the plant. The other one was the parking lots were turned off. Again, no evidence of who actually did that. No evidence that this is gender-based. What the plaintiff tried to do in the court below and what the district court I properly looked at carefully was throw everything in there, every bad thing that she says ever happened to her. My car got keyed. The parking lot lights were turned off once. Somebody said this in some area. Somebody else said this. Throw it all into the mix, stir it up, and say, that's sexual harassment. That's not the analytical framework that the court uses. It's not the analytical framework the district court used. What the district court properly did was look at what happened to this plaintiff, what was supported by admissible evidence, what was within the relevant time period, and what was gender-based. And when you look at those things, the conduct that she's alleged doesn't add up to an actionable hostile work environment. We think about the Pebworth incidents in stretch wrap, called her a bitch three times, talked about her weight, once said she better watch her back. We've got people making references to the wood pallets on the radio in a tasteless joke. I mean, that's basically the sum total of what happened in the stretch wrap department that can be even arguably traced back to sexual harassment. Again, rude, crude, inappropriate conduct is in of it itself enough to establish sexual harassment. And that's what the district court found. As to the packaging area, that's totally different conduct. We've got in packaging Mr. Kitchell. Well, when Ms. Isaacs moves to stretch wrap, she doesn't have any more interaction with Mr. Kitchell. We've got in the stretch wrap.
But the supervisor was the same, and she had repeatedly complained to him in packaging and then continued to complain to him when she was transferred to the other department,
well,
and nothing was basically done.
I
know about the transfer. I mean, she was moved to a different department.
Right.
She continued to complain, and nothing was done.
Yeah, I think that I have a few responses to that question. First, on review of the record, what Ms. Isaac's complaints were. You would think from reading these briefs that the only thing she ever complained about was foul language. She complained about people not giving her breaks. She complained that the other employees weren't working hard enough. She complained that they weren't answering the radio. She complained about a whole variety of things. The only two things that, as of a sexual nature, that she testified that she complained to Mr. Jenkins about were two comments made by Mr. Kitchell. Now, as to the suggestion nothing was done, I disagree with that. She was moved to a new area, and at that point, she worked with different people. She had different job duties. She was physically separated from Mr. Kitchell, and there's no evidence that she had any further problems with him after that point. So whether she thinks that was an adequate response or not, she was actually moved and that problem was resolved. So I don't agree with the characterization that she complained and did nothing. Then she was in the stretch wrap area for a very limited period of time. She was in there from October 2001 until June of 2002. She had the written warning, took a leave of absence, came back for a few shifts, took another incredibly long leave of absence, and at her request was returned to a completely different shift, different area, dry mix with different coworkers. So as far as the nothing was ever done, I don't agree with that. She was moved to three areas to address some of the interpersonal issues that she was reporting. Just to return back to the Morgan case briefly, the EEOC has made the argument that this court, that the district court improperly applied Morgan. I think with the facts, whether this court concludes that there was a waiver or not, the district court did properly apply Morgan because the conduct at issue was different in type, it involved different people, it was in different areas, and it was separated by intervening events. I think I've addressed, in response to question, the sexual harassment issue in general parameters. The bottom line is that when you separate out the conduct that is time-barred, the conduct that is related to people other than Ms. Isaacs, and we've heard a lot in the briefs about Ms. Bender, who has her own claim, and that claim was tried to judgment, and there was a defense verdict. We've heard a lot about Ms. Brown. She had her own claim. The bottom line is that those events that allegedly happened to other people are not part of Ms. Isaacs' hostile work environment. The district court properly parsed through all of those issues and found that what remained really wasn't enough to add up to suggest a hostility and a hostile work environment based on gender. Just to turn very briefly to some of the other timeliness issues, I just want to remind the court, as I mentioned earlier, that for the disparate treatment analysis, there is a different analysis, and that is clear from the standard in Morgan that any conduct that was not subject to a timely filed charge is barred. The Supreme Court was unequivocal on that point. The arguments about reasonable relationship, et cetera, do not hold water following the court's decision in Morgan. And applying that standard, a lot of what we've heard about, the transfer to dry mix, the alleged termination in October 2003, and the actual termination 2 years later, that is all beyond the scope of the charges and should not be considered. In summary, and I'm not going to go through every claim because they're really too numerous to detail, the district court properly and carefully analyzed the record evidence, appropriately applied the Morgan standard to determine what conduct was in and out of the case, carefully sifted through the allegations relating to the hostile work environment, and appropriately analyzed the disparate treatment, retaliation, and FMLA retaliation claims, and granted summary judgment. And for all those reasons, we request that this court affirm the district court. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Darst?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Addressing the issues or the arguments in reverse order, most recent first, on the Morgan case, the Morgan case did not involve the issue that Malhotra ruled on or the related related events after the filing of a charge. The Morgan case involved when should an initial charge be filed. The Morgan case did not cite any of the Seventh Circuit cases that the defendants seek this court to ignore, did not even consider the issue. As a matter of fact, did say that we are not, we do recognize that equitable estoppel does apply, and so although the court did not consider the issue, the court in that respect did recognize the area. So Morgan doesn't say anything about reversing all of the Seventh Circuit's decisions or overruling them or saying that you have to file every time something happens to you, you have to go to the EEOC and file, have multiple EEOC actions, have multiple court actions. Doesn't say anything about that. The defendant raised the issue that other women had complained also, which shows the severity and pervasiveness of the sexual harassment. Bender, for instance, was a female whom Isaacs went with to complain about the sexual harassment early on to the HR department at the Hills plant in Richmond, and the HR department threatened the women with disciplinary action and said, if you this is gossip and don't continue to gossip and don't talk to each other. The defendant said that Kitchell had no more involvement, whereas Kitchell was the person who was present with two other males in the parking lot when Ms. Isaacs found her car keyed, her license plate ripped off, and the lights turned off on her. This is the same night that she complained in a meeting to managers and to the other technicians about the assault on her by Pebworth. And just the same night as the meeting, Kitchell comes out and is there and then laughs and does not show any concern for her, but in fact shows the opposite and laughs at her, which continues his same attitude. And nothing was done to Kitchell. Nothing was done to the male employees. The defendants say something was done. Yeah, they kept transferring the female, the victim, but keep transferring a female from one place to another to try to learn new jobs, to try to get along with team members who she's forced onto in a situation where team members have a say in who is sent to them was very difficult on her, and that's when they told her that they knew she'd filed a complaint. That they called her fucking bitch, and brought her head down with her ears, and she put up with a lot, but she could not take it anymore. Now the defendants also say that they put her on medical leave. They did put her on medical leave, but she requested to come back much earlier than they ever allowed her to come back, and she when she was certified to work in April of 2004, she had to draw unemployment compensation because she wasn't being paid anything. She was certified to work. The employers would not let her come back to work. Finally, after she wouldn't give up, they finally let her come back to work, but they didn't do anything to the males. The defendants argue that she was only called bitch three times. She was actually asked by Pebworth, or told by Pebworth, that her butt was big enough for two men to get on. And he said that twice. She told him not to do it. On the third time that he did it, she said that she cried.
Thank you, Mr.
Durst. In tears. Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement.